Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 16, 2017. A deadly attack in Yei town awakes residents from their sleep.
I also heard gunshots all over Yei. People all scared. I came out at around 9. I thought maybe we're already ambushed.
And President Kiir renames the army in a presidential decree, but later his spokesman says it is still called the SPLA.
It is taken wrong from the reading. Yeah, but the real thing is that the SPLA still remains SPLA. If the change happen, it will happen in future, but not now. It's still SPLA.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Eyewitnesses say at least four people, including soldiers, were killed and scores of others were wounded when members of an armed group attacked government forces on the outskirts of Yei town at dawn today. Yei River State Governor David Lokonga says government forces repulsed the attackers and the town is now calm. For VOA News, Daniel Friday reports from Yei.
Residents say they woke up to the sound of gunfire coming from the direction of Kegulu, some 6 miles west of Yei town, along the road linking Yei to the Democratic Republic of Congo. They say the shooting took everyone by surprise because Yei has been relatively quiet in the past few months. Some residents first thought government soldiers were firing rounds to mark the 34th SPLA anniversary, but knew it was more than celebration when the shooting continued for several hours. Eyewitnesses say the shooting spread to an area behind the teachers' training college, some 2 kilometers from Yei town center, as well as to the Sopiri area southwest of Yei town. A resident who prefers to be identified as Data for security reasons says the shooting finally ended around 9 this morning.
I also heard gunshots all over Yei. People all scared. I came out at around 9. I thought maybe we were already ambushed. People around the
Yei River State Governor David Lokonga Moses blames rebels loyal to the former Vice President Riek Machar for carrying out the attack on government military base.
Enemies of peace at 4:30 a.m. in the morning deliberately attack the position of the SPLA, who are not ordered for any operations. The attack has caused a lot of panic to the entire masses of Yei River. We have 6 SPLA soldiers who are casualties of this attack. The doctors are taking care of them.
Eyewitnesses who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal say they counted 6 dead bodies, including those of soldiers. But Governor David Lokonga told reporters that he was yet to ascertain if any soldiers were killed in the attack.
Up to now, I'm waiting for the update of the place of the attack, if there are other cases who might have lost lives. I'm waiting for this one that will come. I would like to assure my people of Yei River State, especially in the town, the SPLA forces are in full pursuit of the attackers.
Lokonga says the situation has returned to normal and people should go about their normal business. Yei town resident John Luate says the fighting terrified many people. Speaking in Arabic, Luate wondered whether Yei residents will take part in the proposed national dialogue if violence continues.
We as civilians are unhappy with such an attack because we are prepared for the national dialogue announced by the president. If such attacks are happening like this, what will be the outcome and where do we want to take South Sudan?
Another resident who spoke on condition of anonymity for his safety urged the UN to pressure the warring parties to restore peace in South Sudan so that the suffering will end.
We are not feeling very okay because we expect it for the peace, and let the international community put pressure into the 2 parties at least to bring peace, because the common person is the one who suffer in these situations.
Governor Lokonga urged Yei River residents to remain calm, reiterating that government forces are tracking down the attackers. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin in Yei.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir issued several decrees last night creating major changes within the army, including restructuring into three separate forces, a ground force, an air force, and navy units. The new changes are in line with resolutions approved in June by the 5th SPLA Command Council Conference, which authorizes establishment of a Defense Structural Review Committee to review Ministry of Defense and Veteran Affairs and align it with the 2008 SPLA White Paper. Mr. Kiir's restructured army leadership starts with the President as Commander-in-Chief at the head, followed by the Defense and Veteran Affairs Minister. In the new hierarchy, the Chief of General Staff will now be known as Chief of Defense Forces, who will have three assistants for personnel and finance, operation, training and intelligence and logistics, and procurement. Mr. Kiir also formed a 10-member Defense Council to oversee military matters. Presidential spokesman Ateng Wek Ateng says the council will be the army's supreme decision-making body.
It will make the SPLA effective, because now there will be a shared responsibility. Instead of putting them all under one person, there will be collective responsibility. But each commander will have to be responsible to its own particular units of the army, and they will all be accountable to defense councils.
Mainstream and social media reported Mr. Kiir's decree also changed the name of the South Sudan's army from SPLA to South Sudan Defense Forces, but Ateng insists the decree was misunderstood and the South Sudan Army will still be called the SPLA.
It is taken wrong from the reading, yeah, but the real thing is that the SPLA still remain SPLA. If the change happen, it will happen in future, but not now. It's still SPLA.
Mr. Kiir's executive order also reinstated SPLA General Dow Atarjong, who joined Riek Machar's SPLA IO in 2014, but defected back to the government in July last year. Abraham Aolich is a senior policy analyst with the SAD Institute. He says the changes can be viewed as a positive step to improve the image of the army. Aolich says labeling President Kiir as Commander-in-Chief does a lot to improve the image of the army sector, since most South Sudanese view the institution as a tribal army, which has abuse citizens, including committing rape.
Now, if you are talking about Air Force, it's a South Sudanese Air Force. The people who will be serving in that Air Force are South Sudanese. And the hair, that is the same thing with the river. And ground forces, of course, to defend the land of South Sudan. So I think it is an attempt to try to rebrand the army, both to silence critics, but also maybe to portray an image of a professional institution.
The decision to form Defense Council solves past tensions that used to exist between the SPLA Chief of Staff and the Defense Minister. According to Aolich, he says in the past, the Chief of General Staff could report directly to the President instead of the Defense Minister. Aolich says it is clear Mr. Kiir is trying to restore the public's trust in the army, whose reputation has suffered since the fresh wave of fighting erupted in Juba in July last year. The UN and several rights groups have accused the army of mass killing, rape and burning of villages, and looting. Aolich says such changes are fine, but Mr. Kiir needs to focus on implementing security reforms outlined in the 2015 peace agreement,
which says that opposition forces will be integrated into the army. I think that is a necessary step, especially now that there are a number of armed groups in the Equatoria which are not covered by the military arrangement. If there could be a way they can be included in that, and then they are integrated, and now you do professional reform.
Aolich says the president must also send home old officers with a full retirement package and focus on bringing in a new generation of leadership, both in political leadership and organized forces. That report was prepared by Waki Simon Wudu in Juba. As South Sudan marks the 34th day of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, Some soldiers say the SPLA has lost its vision for defending freedom, justice, and equality. The head of the Red Army Foundation says soldiers must be trained and recognized, reorganized to respect the original goals of the army. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
On May 16, 1983, the Sudan People's Liberation Army began its struggle for liberation from the Khartoum government. The Red Army celebrated that day today by recognizing the diversified unity of the Southern Sudanese people to respect their culture, tribes, and religious artifacts. The Red Army Foundation is a non-political organization established in July 2012 by veteran SPLA soldiers who helped liberate South Sudan. Deng Bol Arwai Bol, chairperson of the Red Army Foundation, says over the past few years, the SPLA has failed to meet its vision and abide by its own principles.
The SPLA we have today is not purely the SPLA we used to have in 2005, where everyone was loyal, everyone had a common purpose, everyone cared about civilians, everyone respected their leadership and their hierarchy.
Bol says, today the people are following individuals rather than abiding by the constitution. He says, although the army has failed to protect the people of South Sudan for the last 10 years, President Kiir still has a chance to turn things around. Bol says, for one thing, young people need a program that ensures their future in South Sudan.
I think there is a need to identify all soldiers, old SPLA cadres, bring them together and organize them. When you organize them, you now start training the new ones so that they have the doctrine of the SPLM, SPLA, and that these are soldiers that are friendly to civilians and that know how to defend the constitution instead of defending their tribes.
A soldier who identifies himself as Charles for safety reasons says he joined the army in 2006 but has lost interest because there is no rule of law. Speaking Arabic, Charles says he has not been paid for the last 3 months and his family is starving even though he continues to work.
I am not interested to work because I am sleeping hungry. My children are also sleeping hungry and are not in school. This is not a fair work. When the Anyanya One was in South Sudan, we backed it and wanted to develop our country. Now we are staying hungry without the reality. We didn't join the SPLA, not because of tribalism. We joined the army because of our only flag that was raised.
Another SPLA soldier speaking in a condition of anonymity says he joined the army in 2012 without knowing it would become like what it is today. Still, the young soldier says he will not give up serving the army. He is calling for the international community, including the UN, to help rescue the army from further division.
This is not what we expected. We did not expect SPLA to be of today. We, our leaders, some of our leaders, individuals, I cannot say all the leaders, individuals, they've already failed. So that's why we have lost direction.
The South Sudanese soldiers say the army must be separated from the SPLA political party so that it is a national independent army which defends the rights of the people. Samuel Duar Deng, the SPLM Red Army chairman, says there is need for a dialogue to bring back all the senior SPLA cadres who struggled for the success of the country. Deng says leaders are working with the Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni to bring back members of the army who rebelled against the government.
I think what I am looking at in this meeting is that during that time, he will now be asking all these you call them units within the SPLM, those IOs and former detainees and in government to come again together and move together during the national dialogue process.
Deng believes President Museveni, who was a close ally of the army during the period of liberation, will help restructure the army. The SPLA has splintered into several factions after fighting broke out in Juba in December 2013, with one of the main factions being the SPLA in opposition, led by former first Vice President Riek Machar. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Civil society activists say it's time for a new political process. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there anything you completed simply because you were told you couldn't?
Actually, in my life, all my plans, they are all going on well. There's nothing which has defeated me, and people can say, for you, you are just doing this one, you cannot manage. Actually, I've not gone through that experience.
Yeah, actually, there is. When I was in secondary school, people were telling me that I should not take science section. And they said that I cannot make it. So I decided to take it, and I did it. I did science section, and it was very okay.
Yes, actually, when I started my primary school, some of my friends were telling me that I will never get number one. But because I see it was a challenge, but I tried my level best. After all, I was number one.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about a new report on what has changed in health around the world in a good way. The World Health Organization has released a report on the achievements as well as the challenges in the global health over the past 10 years. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report is called Healthier, Fairer, Safer: The Global Health Journey 2007 to 2017. Sir Liam Donaldson is the author.
I called it Healthier, Fairer, Safer because it seems to me those are the three important dimensions by which you judge progress in global health. Are populations getting healthier? Are they living longer? Are they experiencing fewer episodes of disease? Is it getting fairer?
He says the activities to improve health occur in a very complex world.
The march of globalization has quickened. There, of course, was a major financial crisis in 2008 onwards. Many parts of the world have seen serious armed conflicts and deteriorating security. And as a consequence of that, there have been many displacements of population and the biggest number of people on the move through internal and external migration since the Second World War.
In addition, there's climate change, triggering severe weather events, and a greater number of people moving to cities. But Donaldson says there have been very significant improvements in global health over the past decade.
We've seen falls in maternal mortality, falls of mortality in children under the age of 5. Death rate from HIV/AIDS has fallen. Death rate from tuberculosis has fallen. Death rate from malaria has fallen. And to achieve these things, the action has been on a very, very large scale. For example, for malaria, there were 900 million insecticide mosquito nets distributed in Africa over that period of time.
But, he says, there's also work being done by the World Health Organization that does not receive as much attention, such as getting presidents and prime ministers involved in global health. In other words, raising political will.
And that means getting health onto the United Nations main agenda. So we can look at the so-called non-communicable diseases, obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, those things that do kill people, but often they leave them with many years of life in illness and disability. That's something that's been considered by the United Nations.
Donaldson says the WHO produces big policies that shape the future. One of them is healthy aging.
We know that many more people now are living longer, but what's crucial about those extra years of life is whether they are spent in health or in disease and disability and incapacity. And if we look forward 40 years, 80% of the world's populations over 60s will be in low and middle-income countries, not in the richer countries of the world.
Other major WHO policy efforts include universal health coverage, raising health gains in poor countries to match those of rich nations, and addressing society's attitudes toward the disabled.
There are many other things in the report, concentrating, for example, on the neglected tropical diseases, which affect 1 billion people in 149 countries. Great progress there. 40 treatments for neglected tropical diseases now being given every second in the world as a result of a major push forward on action on that.
The report covers the time during which Dr. Margaret Chan was Director General of the World Health Organization. The next WHO chief will be chosen at the World Health Assembly on May 23rd. It will be the first time WHO member countries will elect the Director General, who will then take office in July. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A group of South Sudanese civil society members in the diaspora are complaining that the international community has maintained the status quo when it comes to the political crisis in their home country. Ben Gideon, a civil society activist in Kampala, says the group is urging the international community to come up with a new political process to advocate for permanent ceasefire.
So we agree that a revised political process must take place. However, the approach should be different. It should not be like the IGAD-led process. We agree that there should be a bilateral political process between political and military elites. That is track one. While on the other hand, there should be a separate track where other non-stakeholders, non-state actors, such as the civil society, the religious group, the women, the youth, a professional association, should have their own inputs and submission that would fit into the larger political process. So we agree that it's a two-way track political process should happen. And that should be intermediary advisory body at the ministerial level that could advise the parties to the political process, that could also visit the constituencies in South Sudan to solicit their view directly on the resolution of the conflict in South Sudan.
A peace process was signed in August 2015, and through it, a transitional government of national unity was formed. Where does a transitional government fall under in this new process you're urging?
I was part of that political process that signed the agreement. I was personally involved in the negotiation of the agreement. But what we are calling for right now is not totally a new situation. We are calling for a resuscitation of the peace agreement. We are calling to revisit some chapters of the agreement. And these chapters of the agreement are basically security and leadership aspect of the peace agreement. There is total breakdown of central command and order across the country. There is contest. There is crisis of leadership. There is crisis of legitimacy of the transitional government of nationality. In actual sense, we have a partial transitional government of nationality. It's not that inclusive to ensure the livelihood of the transitional government of nationality.
What's your response to comments by government officials that the transitional government is indeed inclusive?
The major access to the transitional government of nationality that were supposed to form the TIGONU, the transitional government of nationality, are not all on board. So you cannot call it a transitional government of nationality that inclusive. One of the major partners to the peace agreement are not on board.
You also argue that the proposed political process should precede the national dialogue. What do you mean by that?
The current national dialogue exercise, which is going on, should not replace the peace agreement. It is not inclusive, as such. In the political process that we have proposed, we are saying that the national dialogue is very important and it will be a mandate of the political process so that the parties to the peace agreement and other South Sudanese stakeholders and the international guarantors would agree and design the way forward, including method and procedures for the national dialogue to take place. Because it has no term of reference. The current national dialogue process, which is ongoing, has no term of reference, does not provide the rule of procedure on how it should be engaged. So we said it should be part and part of the political process so that people come up with the ways how the national dialogue is going to shift the objective.
That was South Sudanese civil society activist Ben Gideon speaking to Ayen Bior from Kampala earlier today. South Sudanese researchers and activists say oil-producing communities are not getting their fair share of oil revenues as stipulated in the country's constitution. South Sudan's law provides that oil-producing states shall receive 2% of oil revenues and another 3% for communities that host oil sites. As Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba, the government says it will pay all the money due to communities once the economic crisis is solved and peace has returned to the country.
At a SED Institute public lecture last week to talk about the management of petroleum revenues for petroleum-producing communities, the Institute's executive director said South Sudan must find a fair and transparent way of sharing oil revenues between central and sub-national governments and communities. Jock Madud Jock says the country must do more to reverse what's known as the resource curse, a situation in which natural resources like petroleum and minerals are produced without gains for local communities, which he says results in poverty, violence, and political instability.
Our country is very rich in resources and our people are very poor. That is an equation we cannot accept. So it is important for us to explore these sources of revenue for our government. And we say that these revenues belong to the people above all. The government is only a custodian. So there is no reason why big people in government offices in Juba should have the biggest share of resources while the people from underneath whom the resources are removed should go poor.
Jock says the government must immediately give back to oil-producing communities the money they were guaranteed.
You have structures, you have laws, but you never carry them out. Part of it is to do with the lack of political will at the top to make people really adhere to the laws. Part of it is to do with the capacity of people to ensure that the skills necessary for the implementation of these laws are available. So, but that is not something that you are born with. As a young country, you are not born with those skills. You have to develop them.
Mary Ayen, a member of South Sudan's Council of States, who represents the newly created Ruweng State, hails from Alin County, an oil-producing area of South Sudan. She says her county suffers from the negative impact of oil production, including water and air pollution, but receives no benefits from the oil.
If you go to, like, to my place, you don't believe really that this is one of the areas that are giving sacrifice and giving revenue to the whole nation. The infrastructure is still very poor, the health facilities, the education system, and just all the basic needs, like the water and all these, are still very retarded.
South Sudan Deputy Finance Minister Mau Ambrose says, so far as he knows, communities and oil-producing states do receive money guaranteed to them by law. But since the war broke out in 2013, the government has not been able to pay them.
Are battling with paying the salaries and the operations. We are battling with even meeting our obligation towards the peace implementation. This is all money, and that's what we think is the priority at the moment.
For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Espiele Woye with Dynamic. I am John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you sharing your evening with us. We hope you can join us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.